Now Jesus begins by warning them against deception. And I would like to say that almost every passage in the Bible that deals with the close of the age contains some warning against deception. I think the greatest danger that threatens us as Christians at this time is being deceived. And I don't believe any one of us is immune to the danger. I certainly don't count myself immune. I pray continually together with Ruth that God will keep us from deception. I fastened on some words of the Apostle Paul some years ago in 1 Corinthians 7:25, where he says, I give my opinion as one who has obtained mercy of the Lord to be found faithful. And it became so clear to me at that time that it's only through the Lord's mercy that we can be found faithful. And I think Ruth would bear me out, there's scarcely a week passes without our praying specifically for mercy to be found faithful and to be kept from error. And I would like to say the wedge that Satan uses to insert error is pride. I don't believe any Christian who remains humble will fall into error. But when we become arrogant and think we've got all the answers and we know everything, we are almost certain to be deceived. So I want to give this warning collectively to all of us. Let's be humble before the Lord. Let's be teachable. Let's not imagine we know it all or we have all the answers. And let us acknowledge our dependence upon the Lord to keep us faithful to His truth. So this is what Jesus said in verses 4 and 5. Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. That's His first response. Then He says, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. From now on, I'm going to use the word Messiah. You understand, Messiah is the Hebrew form, Christ is the Greek form. But Messiah has much more meaning in this context. From now on, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. One thing about Jesus is he's a true prophet. The Jewish encyclopedia records in the centuries that followed Jesus, about 40 false messiahs who came to the Jews and deceived some of them. One of the most famous was Bar Kokhba, who led the revolt against Rome in 132 AD. Another was a man named Sabbatai Tzvi in the year 1666, who claimed to be the Messiah and led a whole lot of Jewish people back to the Middle East and ultimately converted to Islam. There was one called Moses of Crete, about the 5th century of this era, who claimed to be the Messiah and led hundreds of Jewish people into the sea to meet the Messiah, and they all drowned. So Jesus was perfectly right when he said, many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. And many have come in this century. It's not out of date. As a matter of fact, Ruth and I, as you know, live in Jerusalem. This past summer, I forget the exact month, very beautifully printed signs appeared in Hebrew in the main streets of Jerusalem saying the Messiah will be on the Mount of Olives on Sunday morning, such and such a date, go out and meet him. I don't know who put them there, but there they were. I don't think many people went out to meet him. I don't think even the media turned up, but it's just a symptom of what's happening. Then Jesus begins to answer the question, what will be the sign? But he doesn't come immediately to the answer. In verse 6, he says, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. In other words, the whole age will be marked by continual turmoil and wars. And I don't suppose there's been a single century, perhaps not even a single decade since that time to this, that there has not been a war somewhere in the world. Since World War II, I think some American news magazine calculated there'd been nearly 50 wars in the world. But Jesus says that in itself is not the sign. That will be going on all the time. Now, the next two verses are crucial, and we need to read them together. That's verse 7 and 8. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. I don't know that I asked people to read with me, but it's wonderful that you did. All right, now, verse 8. All these are the beginning of sorrows. That's the New King James, but it obscures the real meaning. I think all the more modern translations say birth pangs or labor pains. So putting those two verses together, verse 7 describes what the Lord calls the beginning of the birth pangs or the labor pains. That's very important. Now, what is to be born? If there are going to be birth pangs, there has to be a birth. My answer is, what will be born out of the birth pangs is the kingdom of God under the kingship of Jesus established on earth. And I just refer you to one verse in Matthew 19. Matthew 19 and verse 28. Because I want to pick out a phrase. Jesus said to them, his disciples, "Assuredly I say to you that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Notice when he says, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, that's speaking about the establishment of his kingdom visibly on earth. And he says it will happen in the regeneration. You know what regeneration means? Rebirth. We talk about regeneration in the experience of a Christian being born again. But here Jesus is using the phrase not of an individual, but of the whole earth. See, one of the exciting things about the kingdom of God is it comes only by a birth. You can't organize it, you can't promote it, you can't plan it. Jesus said about the individual, no one can see or enter the kingdom of God unless he has been born again, regenerated. What is true of the individual is true of the earth. The earth cannot experience the kingdom of God until this period that Jesus calls the regeneration. Then he said, in the regeneration, I'll be sitting on my throne and you apostles will be sitting on your thrones. So what is to be born through these birth pangs is the kingdom of God established on earth. It's coming only by a birth. Now let's go back to Matthew 24 and look at what are the beginning of labor pains. Now it's verse 7. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. That's different from the wars and rumors of wars. There have been wars going on, a background of wars all the time, but now these wars erupt into major international conflicts. Nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. One of the significant phrases we never used before the 20th century was world war. But this century has seen two world wars. I believe that's what Jesus had in mind. Personally, and this is a personal opinion, World War I was probably the distinctive beginning of the labor pains. Since that time, the world has never really recovered. It's gone from crisis to crisis, and each crisis tends to be more severe than the previous one. So if I am right, and this is something for you to consider for yourself, the beginning of the labor pains will be the great world wars. But associated with them, there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. So take them together. World wars, famines, pestilences, and earthquakes, when they occur in the same period of time on a major scale, are the indication that the birth pangs have begun. Now, just for the sake of convenience, we'll take one brief look in Luke 21. Verse 11, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines, and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. Jesus speaks about the same signs, earthquakes, famines, pestilences, but he also adds great sights and signs from heaven, which I believe is a later phase of the same period. I would say basically all those are taking place in this century. We are the first century that's had two world wars. In fact, they never could have been world wars before that because the means of travel and communication didn't permit it. The number of earthquakes recorded is continually increasing. There are various diseases, particularly at this time, AIDS, which are sweeping the human race and will ultimately wipe out certain nations if changes don't take place. Sub-Saharan Africa is in danger of becoming a ghost community because of AIDS. And then famine. There are now 250,000 children between ages 1 and 5 dying every week of famine. That's 13 million children. That's not the whole story, that's just the children. There are probably 40 or 50 million people dying every year of famine today, mainly in Africa at the present time, but in a number of other areas of the earth. Going back to Matthew 24, all these, verse 8, all these are the beginning of birth pangs. Now we have what I believe are some other birth pangs that follow. And I want you to notice the repetition of thens in the following verses, the word then. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. How many of you would agree that's a birth pang? Who's you? I didn't hear you. Us, that's right. That's not good English, but you is us. All right? I think many Christians just read that happily and just pass it by, but it's a warning to us. We will be hated by all nations. Now, in a country such as this, that's not very real, but in probably half the nations of the earth, it's already true. And the nations with the highest population, particularly China. And then, verse 10, then many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Many who? Didn't hear you. Christians, that's right. What does it mean, will be offended? It means they'll give up their faith. They won't be able to take the pressure. They'll, not merely will they do that, but to save themselves, they'll betray their fellow believers. Now, this has happened frequently in the Soviet Union, in China, and in other countries like that. Verse 11, then many false prophets will rise and deceive many. Basically, a false prophet produces a cult. Every cult is the result of a false prophet. It's estimated that this century there have been approximately 10,000 false cults. These statistics are given by very responsible sources. Verse 12, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Many who? Christians, that's right. The word love is there, is agape. So because of abounding lawlessness, those Christians who are not insulated spiritually from the world will lose their first love. How many of you in your lifetime have seen an alarming upsurge of lawlessness in your nation? That's right. And I put my hand up for two nations, Britain and America. And this abounding lawlessness is going to threaten us as Christians with losing our love. Unless, as I say, we're insulated from the world. We aren't affected by what goes on in the world. Then verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Who will be saved? The one who endures to the end. You're saved already. Those of you that believe in Jesus and committed your life to him, but to remain saved, what are you going to have to do? Endure to the end. Just keep your finger there and turn to Luke 21 again, that we turn backwards and forwards from time to time. Luke 21, verse 19. Jesus is speaking about the same kind of situation, and he says, "In your patience, possess your souls." That's the New King James. It's not very clear. I would say, by your endurance, purchase the salvation of your souls. The price you're going to have to pay to stay saved is endurance. Are you preparing for that? I have to say, mentally, I am. There's a prayer that I've begun to pray pretty regularly. It's the last part of the Lord's Prayer. When I see what's coming, I pray this: lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. I say to God, "God, you know how much I can stand. I don't want to betray you. I don't want to deny my faith. So don't lead me into temptation. Don't lead me into a situation that's too much for me. But deliver me from the evil one." This has become very real to me. All right, going back to Matthew 24, you've noticed the thens. Now, we've had now a number of signs, probably about 7 or 8 specific signs, but we haven't had the sign. Now, in verse 14, we get the sign. This is one of the most crucial verses for us at this time. What is the sign? "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." That's very specific. Jesus was asked, "What will be the sign of the end?" Here he has answered, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." That's a specific answer to a specific question. Very important for us, because whose responsibility is it to preach the gospel? Ours, that's right. We can't expect the political leaders to do it. We can't expect the educators to do it. We can't expect the scientists to do it or the military commanders. We are the ones to do it. And the destiny of the nations is in our hands. We are the most significant people on earth, not because of what we are in ourselves, but because of what we can do. In 2 Peter chapter 3, well, maybe we should look there for a moment. Keep your finger in Matthew 24 and look in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. 2 Peter 3, 11 and 12. "Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved," and that is really the entire earth, "what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God?" We are supposed to be doing two things: looking for it, expecting it, and hastening it. You see, if we can hasten it, we can also delay it. How do we hasten it? By proclaiming the good news of the kingdom to all the nations. If we don't do it when we could, what are we doing? We are delaying the coming of the Lord. And when you consider the agony that earth is suffering until the Lord comes, it's a fearful responsibility for the church to take upon itself to prolong that agony.